Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. A preview on this hopefully lazy Friday after Thanksgiving. Lazy for the Americans who simply can't face the stores on fearsome Black Friday, that is. Even the sound of that name suggests a belching smokestack of consumption. You might say that while Black Friday symbolizes everything unsustainable on our planet, there is something happening this holiday season that will attempt to point the way toward a more sustainable future. That's right, Americans in Paris, and not only. This hour of The Takeaway is dedicated to the more than 190 leaders and countless other activists and scientists from all over the world who will soon be getting down to business in Paris at the International Summit on Climate Change. It's officially called COP21, the Conference of the Parties. It will, for the first time, try to reach agreement on tangible emission and consumption targets for nations, cities, industries, and other institutions to meet. The targets and goals of COP21 will then be presented and presumably sold to citizens of participating nations who then have to decide how they can make it to Paris, or reach the Paris goals anyway. The summit opens amidst a curious and emotional time for a city that has hosted talks to end wars and to rewrite the borders of nations down through history. Paris is a city still in shock from the November 13th attacks. We reached out to Laura Haim, the chief White House correspondent for the French cable channel Canal Plus. She says Parisians are still committed to the climate summit, but are having a hard time reconciling the urgency of environmental events that happen on a planetary schedule with the urgency of terrorism that snuffed out so many lives in an instant this month.
It was supposed to be an amazing event. It was supposed to be something that all the French people were writing for, to at least try to do something about the climate. It's a very big problem and it's a very big issue in France. So everybody before the attacks was, in a way, happy to have this conference in Paris. And now it's really in the back of their mind.
It's in the back of their mind. The significance of it isn't erased. Do you think that Parisians don't really want the spotlight on Paris right now, don't want to worry about that security right now, would rather worry about their daily lives?
No, it's quite the opposite. Parisians want to have a normal life. And when I speak with, again, my family, my friends, people are telling me, okay, let's do that. Let's create this movement to go to a restaurant. Let's go to a terrace. Let's show to the world that we're not afraid. The climate, however, is a different event because you have a lot of political leaders from all over the world who are coming to the climate conference. So people are saying, it's going to be much more a summit against terrorism than something regarding the climate, at least at the beginning. You have to keep in mind that it's going to be for 11 days, but the first 2 days with all the head of the states coming to Paris, I heard that some of them already want to go to the Bataclan. So the security and the topics are completely focused on safety, security, and tourism in the first 2 days.
And that sense of mourning may actually be reasonable cover for the conference if they don't accomplish all the goals that they want. People won't pay as much attention because the city, again, is focused on other things.
Oh, yes, absolutely. The city is completely focused on other things. And also the city in the middle of the climate conference and the country, they are going to focus on the elections. In the middle of this climate conference, you have the regional election, December 6th and December 13th, with the far right, which is really, really high in the polls with Marine Le Pen. People are extremely, extremely interested and concerned by the rise of the far right, by what's going to happen if the National Front is winning those elections. And it's happening in the middle of the climate conference.
Laura Haim, White House correspondent for the French TV channel Canal Plus. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
The Kyoto Protocol was first agreed back in 1997. It required industrialized countries to make specific cuts in greenhouse gas emissions. But developing countries, including big polluters like China, were not forced to cut. In contrast to the Kyoto Protocol, this time around, both developed and developing countries are submitting voluntary pledges to cut their own greenhouse gas emissions, which has raised immediate concerns about how anyone can actually be held to account. Our next guest has been helping a number of governments prepare for the 21st Conference of the Parties, COP21 for short, held this year in Paris. Michael Jacobs is senior advisor to the Global Commission on the Economy and Climate and its new climate economy project. Jacobs is convinced the decision to move away from mandates is a much better way to bring about lasting change.
In Kyoto, the world was trying to divide up a total amount of greenhouse gases, which it felt could be emitted by all countries in the world, and divide it up in some way fairly between all the different countries, which proved very difficult. And this time round, we're trying to do something very different, which is to say to every country, do what you can. And every country is now finding its own way of doing this. And it isn't being asked to take a target by the international community as a whole. So the United States is now embarked on its own emissions reduction plan, which is also achieving much better air quality and other economic goals, jobs and so on. And every country is now doing the same kind of exercise. And because it's now up to each country, you're getting much, much more buy-in from many more people within the economy. Businesses are saying, yes, we can do this. And so what the world is trying to do in Paris is to come together with all these national plans now and see whether they add up to enough. And if they don't, to try and then put themselves on a course to do more in the future. So in many ways, Kyoto was a kind of top-down international process in which countries were being asked to do things by others. Paris is a bottom-up process in which countries are saying, this is what we think we can do. Let's put these all together and let's try and achieve the global effort in that way.
Who decides what is enough and what would be the politics of that calculation?
Well, the scientists tell us what is enough to limit global warming, the rise in global temperature, to 2 degrees, which is what the international community has agreed. We should try not to cross that threshold. And so the scientists are then telling us, well, if you don't want to do that, then you are going to have to limit emissions over a long period, 50, 60, 70 years, to a certain amount. And that amount, we now have some idea what that is from the science. And so in a sense, what is now happening is that countries are putting forward their national plans, and then the scientists are saying, well, this is where we think you need to be, and there is a gap. And we know there is a gap between what countries are putting forward and what the scientists say we need to do to achieve this international goal. And so the Paris negotiations are about how can the world close that gap in the future. And that's the challenge that we now have in front of every country in the world.
How do we evaluate each individual country's good faith effort to say we're doing something, and are emitter countries like the United States and China held to different standards than countries that are, in a sense, victims of the consequences of climate change, nations that are close to sea level?
We don't need to take this on good faith. The agreement will introduce rules and extend rules that we already have for how countries should report and monitor and verify their emissions. And this is, of course, already happening. So this is not just about future action. We know, for example, that China over the last 6 or 7 years has been reducing its emissions growth very, very considerably. There is a big distinction now between the countries that have major emissions and the countries that are primarily experiencing climate change, but whose own contribution to that process has been very small. So the least developed countries, the poorest countries in the world, produce almost no emissions of their own, but are already experiencing climate change very strongly. So part of this agreement that we're trying to reach in Paris is about how we can be fair.
How do you deal with what I'm dubbing the Volkswagen problem, where a country might behave very, very well during the Paris conference and in the years just afterwards, but then actually end up polluting quite a lot between now and the time the nations get together again?
When we last tried to do this at Kyoto, there was a very strong sense that this was all a burden, that trying to reduce emissions was basically a cost that we would all have to bear. And it might be a cost that we needed to bear because we were trying to solve a global problem, but nevertheless, it wasn't really something that was in our national self-interest, seen from our own perspective. That is no longer the case. What's really interesting now is that countries are acting on greenhouse gas emissions because it is in their interest to do so. So China, for example, is now cutting coal out of its system at a rate much, much faster than we thought it would be doing, not primarily because of the climate benefits, although those are very important, but because coal produces local air pollutants which kill people and which cause terrible respiratory illnesses. And it's for that reason that China is now acting on its emissions. And that should give us great confidence that it will carry on doing so, because that's not about its obligations to the international community. It's about ensuring that its people are healthier.
So bearing on your experience in Bonn recently, what do you think the main political hot points are going to be in Paris or leading up to Paris?
So I think the core issue in Paris is, does the agreement bring in a regular process of review and improvement of the climate plans that countries have? So we've now got every country in the world, more or less, over 150 countries have now produced their national climate plans with their targets and policies for 2025 and 2030. But we know that more has to be done if we're to hold global warming to the 2 degrees, which the international community has said we must. And that means that in another 5 years' time, we're going to have to do this again with a new set of targets for 5 years further ahead, and perhaps to look again at the ones that we've already got. And that needs to happen every 5 years, so that there is a regular process of improvement and further ambition until we get down to the point at which we can feel confident that we are able to hold global warming to that 2 degrees. And that is the most important thing, I think, which needs to be agreed in Paris. A regular cycle of commitments where every country bears down on its emissions progressively over time.
Michael Jacobs is senior advisor to the Global Commission on the Economy and Climate, looking forward to the Paris talks on climate change and the agreement that will come after that UN climate conference. Thanks so much, Michael.
My pleasure. Many thanks.